It's time to say goodnight to inefficient night storage heaters. Bulky, unattractive, with no precise control, leaving you boiling in the morning and rather chilly at night. So tune in to Fisher Future Heat, home heating systems that give you a steady, controllable supply of heat 24 hours a day. Search Fisher Future Heat today. Fisher Future Heat. The future is electric. For years and years, heating has meant boilers, and boilers have meant breakdowns. Over here, and over here. Anything but music to your ears. At Fisher Future Heat, we create state-of-the-art home heating systems that we fit, then you forget, with no annual servicing needed and a huge 10-year guarantee. In short, we engineer common sense. Search Fisher Future Heat today. Fisher Future Heat. The future is electric.
Welcome to Nerd Pod. This is episode 33 of the Nerd Party. Thank you so much for downloading, subscribing, and listening. It really means a lot to us. And thank you so much for going to our new website. I just checked the numbers over the weekend, and we're getting a little bit more web traffic than we normally do. So we really do appreciate that. And please make sure to go to our Facebook page as well, facebook.com/thenerdparty. And there you can interact with us, comment on our previous episodes or this episode right here that you're listening to.
Yeah, and Tristan, if I'm not mistaken, you've been doing some work on the website itself to include, we now have, not that, if anyone's interested, we now have pictures with our bios on our webpage, so.
Yes, that's right. Yes, you. If you have no idea what Matt and I look like, you can go to our website and see pictures of us. And also, we're starting a new blog feature. Right now, we only have one blog post, but we're going to get more, and we're going to get more contributors. And it's not just going to be Matt and I. We're opening it up to people that we know who are good writers and also people whose opinions that we respect. And if you have a nice if you feel like you have a nice writer's voice and you have something interesting to say, then reach out to us at contact@thenerdparty.com. Send us your stuff and we might post it.
So we haven't recorded, obviously, for a couple of weeks, and we're getting to that time of year again where lots of news comes out. I don't know why, but October seems to be a buzz month for a lot of different things, because I guess we're 2 months away from all the winter blockbusters, and we are a lot of the summer trailers start coming out in October too. I don't know why. It's like Christmas. It comes earlier each and every year. But so what do we have on the docket this week?
The official poster for Star Wars, The Force Awakens. And it's a really badass poster. I think it's really well made. It's very Star Wars.
I was going to say, it's very evocative of some of the original posters.
Yes, and I love how they keep that theme going. Like, ever since the originals were re-released, and then also once we got the prequels, they had this established style that they kept moving forward with. And there were some, you know, derivations thereof, and they kind of branched out a little bit here and there, but they all kind of had that central theme, and this is no different. But one thing that is kind of a surprise to everyone, and that is Luke Skywalker is nowhere to be found.
Luke Skywalker hasn't been a presence in any of the marketing material now, but it's very interesting that we're now only 2 months out from the release of the film, and we don't even know what he looks like in the film.
Yeah, we know that he, like, we saw Mark Hamill during the time of filming, and he had a really scraggly beard. That's all that we know about what he's going to look like. But the thing is, I mean, it could be something different. You know, we don't know. And in the trailer, we did see a robotic hand placed on R2-D2. Now, it's not confirmed that it's Luke Skywalker, but it's a huge possibility that it was. And so that's the only kind of tidbit of Luke Skywalker that we've gotten. And I think, like, you and I were just talking before we started recording about how strange this is, but the thing is that it has to be something bigger, because there's no way in hell, like, Luke Skywalker is not included on the poster just because he barely has any presence in the movie. There's no way that's possible.
No. No, this is classic J.J. Abrams. I mean, like, he's doing a very good job, once again, of not showing too much, but showing enough to keep you enticed. And I think it's kind of, you know, I'm... people might be confused about it, but I actually applaud him holding back on certain things.
Yeah, and also one thing that was included that is kind of a surprise is that it looks like there's a cousin to the Death Star in the upper right corner.
Yeah. I the whole internet has been trying to figure out what that is. Twitter's been all abuzz about it.
I mean, it's spherical like the Death Star. Like, so imagine the Death Star with, you know, like the center ring cut out, and you see the laser mechanism visible.
A cannon, it looks like.
Yeah, it looks like some sort of cannon.
I've heard different rumors about what this possibly is. Something about a planet killer. It's got some sort of name that I've heard bandied about. That it's not confirmed because no one knows a thing about this movie. Yeah. But I've heard something about a new super weapon being in this film. So that possibly could be it.
And we also get our first real good look of Carrie Fisher as Princess Leia. Now, there was a photo of her leaked months ago, but it was really low resolution, really tiny, and you couldn't quite tell, you know, like what was going on. And in this one, she has a really she doesn't have the buns like she did in New Hope. Obviously, she wouldn't, but she does have kind of a very cool Star Wars hairdo going on that I think they did a very good job with.
You know what, and this is absolutely no insult to Carrie Fisher, who I like and has a, you know, wacky sense of humor and is all around crazy. If you've never seen the video of her recent Broadway One Woman show, it's one of the funniest shows I've ever seen. But I looked at that poster and I'm like, they smoothed her out a little bit.
Yes. I mean, every image that you see online and in magazines and everything like that, 99.9% of the time, it is photoshopped, and that's fine. But there is a thing where, like, if you look at this image, it's kind of egregious. Like, they took 30 years off.
I was going to say, because, like, it almost looks like this is, like, months after Jedi. Like, I'm not mistaken, am I? This looks like they de-aged her.
And, like, Carrie Fisher would be the first person to say, what the hell?
Well, I wonder, like, you know, because, I guess we'll see, because we haven't really seen her in action. I mean, we've seen behind the scenes photos, which, you know, may or may not represent how she will actually look in the finished film. And we have this poster image. So now I'm wondering, you know, as silly as this sounds, I wonder if they've perhaps digitally de-aged her a little bit in the finished product.
I doubt it. I think this is just an overzealous Photoshop.
You're probably right.
I don't think they're going to do any de-aging because they obviously did not do any de-aging with Harrison Ford.
No, they did not.
But the thing is, they stayed true to his image, at least a little bit, in the poster. Like, he looks older. Like, he looks like an aged Han Solo, which is how he should look. But, you know, with Carrie Fisher, yeah, this looks like Carrie Fisher in the 90s.
It does. It does. Okay, I'm glad I wasn't just seeing things then.
No. But we also have some other geek news, much smaller.
We have some other tidbits that we can go through. You go ahead, and then I have a couple that I just want to touch on briefly.
Well, mine is even smaller than yours, because you gleamed yours to me earlier. But I am a big fan of Batman video games. I'm a big fan of Batman in general. But Batman video games, I think, are some of the best video games out there. And the Arkham series is my favorite video game series of all time. Hands down. Fantastic. More than Mass Effect, more than Fable. And the latest iteration from Rocksteady, Arkham Knight, has not been a disappointment. It has been fantastic. It is the reason why I bought an Xbox One. And I do not regret the decision in the least. And so right now, I have a $400 Batman machine. And I'm okay with that. But one thing that has been getting some criticism for, it's not so much the gameplay or the video game itself, but it's Season Pass. And for those of you who aren't big gamers, you might not know what that means. And Season Passes are getting kind of a bad rap right now. I'm not saying it's undeserved, but they're getting a bad rap right now because it's extra content that the studio is trying to sell to you before you even know what it is. So you buy a game for $50, $60, and then they say, oh, would you like to subscribe to a season pass? We're like, well, how much is that? Well, you know, it's $20. Well, it used to be like $10, then $15, then $20. And the Arkham Knight one was $30. And so a lot of people are like, why would I spend half of the price of the game for content that I don't know what I'm going to get? You know, why not just release that with the game? Why am I only buying a third of a game or half a game? with the Batman stuff, you know, like the season passes, like, you know, like you can change your Batman character to look like different types of Batmans throughout the comics or from the movies or things like that. You can change the skin of your Batmobile to look like the 1989, you know, Batmobile, you know, stuff that's really cool, but does it warrant $30?
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. And also like extra challenge maps and like a story where you're Harley Quinn or something like that. And a lot of people have been saying, like, a lot of people bought into it. It's like, well, it's Batman, so I'll spend $30 on it because I'm sure it'll be great. And it's been kind of lame,
mm-hmm.
but I am not one of those people who bought season passes. And so I've just been buying things that I've been interested in here and there because you can buy it piece by piece. And so I've just been buying the skins that I like for a buck here and a buck there. And so I've been, for once, one of the smarter people here. And the reason why I'm bringing it up is because a couple months ago or a month ago, they came out with 1989 Tim Burton, Michael Keaton Batman skin. And I've been playing the entire game like that. And it's been awesome. And soon, I think this month or next month, they're coming out with Batman versus Superman pack.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to look like you can have a skin of Ben Affleck's suit as well as Ben Affleck's Batmobile in the Arkham Knight.
Right.
And it looks super, super cool. And in December, they're coming out with, it just says 2008 movie Batman skin. So it's going to be the Dark Knight. But the thing is, though, technically, you had the Batman Begins skin in 2008 as well, in the opening of the Dark Knight. And so they haven't revealed yet which one it's going to be. Like, I think they sent out a poll, like, what would you either have, the Batman Begins skin or the Dark Knight skin? And I'm pretty sure the Dark Knight skin is probably going to win out.
See, I didn't even realize that Batman Begins and Dark Knight had two different costumes.
No, yes, you did.
No, I really didn't. And
No,
I've only seen both of those movies twice.
You're trying to tell me that you could not see the difference between Batman Begins and Dark Knight?
No, I probably could. I just don't remember.
Oh, Matthew.
It's not my favorite superhero film.
So I'm excited about that. I mean, like, yes, is that freakishly low on the nerd scale of news? Yes. Yes, it is. But it's important to me, and so I wanted to talk about it.
Well, I have three pieces of tidbit news that I just want to speed through real quick so we can get to our main topic. One just came out today, you know, lower key than the Star Wars news, but news that I'm certainly interested in. Matt Reeves has posted on Twitter the first set photo from the new Planet of the Apes film, which I guess is going to be called War for the Planet of the Apes. Is that finalized? I guess it is.
I think it is.
Which I'm fine with. I mean, I think it's funny that in the same series we had an original movie called Battle for the Planet of the Apes, and now it's War for the Planet of the Apes. Hopefully,
gotta up the stakes.
Hopefully this is better than Battle, because Battle wasn't so amazing. But but he posted the first official set image, and I don't know if it's an intentional homage or whether or not he's just doing that for the benefit of Twitter because it looks nice, but it's a picture of a couple mocap people, and one of them is on horseback, and they happen to be alongside a beach that looks remarkably similar to the beach from the original film.
Like, it's the same, like, they're on the same side of the beach, and, you know, the water's on the right side of the frame, just like in Planet of the Apes at the end with Charlton Heston. And I definitely think they're going for an homage. At least Matt Reeves is just like, oh, do you think this will be cool for the internet? You know, that kind of thing.
Right. It keeps making me wonder, because I know that you know, we're in a reboot verse, but it makes me wonder, are we still building up to where, are they eventually going to try to connect this to the 68 film? Because I still think that would be cool.
Well, I mean, you and I have talked about it at length. I mean, we started this podcast on Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, I know, but like seeing pictures like this and seeing like what they're trying to do with this third film, like it makes me wonder. Yeah, maybe they really are going for the endpoint is 68.
I think so, because I mean, you and I shared our fan theory with the rest of the world about how it is still possible that we are in the Planet of the Apes, like the original Planet of the Apes timeline, because there were already two timelines in the original movies. And so we could be in that first timeline still.
Right. which is really cool, and it's certainly possible. I think that wasn't there like a quick scene in Rise where you saw a ship taking off, and that's supposedly the ship that has Charlton Heston's crew on it.
There was a newspaper that fell down on the ground, like a delivery boy, a newspaper boy was delivering it, and we see the headline. It's like latest like space crew is lost in space or something like that. Astronauts are lost.
Right.
And it was a 100% homage to the original film, and it had to have been talking about Chuck Heston's crew.
Right. Well, I'm really excited. It looks cool. This is the same director and the same writer from Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which for my money, it was the better of the two, although I really liked Rise. Mm-hmm. I loved Dawn. So I can't wait. This is coming out in July of 2017. So I'm glad they're starting it now, because I have to imagine with all the mocap and really how amazing the work looked in the finished product of Dawn, especially. Yeah. Like, it probably takes that much time, so.
These movies take forever with post-production. And, yeah, would I have liked to have come out of July of next year? Of course. But that's just not realistic with this kind of technology.
Actually, I'm kind of glad that it's not coming out in July of next year, because I would have a hard time being torn between cannibalizing it and Star Trek, in the same month.
Well, I'd see both.
I'd see both, but you never know how these things work. But so I'm really excited about that. That's cool. And talking about my kind of comic book news, since you had yours, I'll have mine. It was pretty much all but confirmed this week, because I'm taking these stories from Variety and other reputable internet sources. Mark Ruffalo has supposedly been confirmed to appear as Hulk in the third Thor movie.
So that has been confirmed, because I know it was a rumor a couple of days ago.
Well, a couple of days ago is when it... So I'll just read the article I've pulled off of Variety. This is dated October 15th. Mark Ruffalo is in final negotiations to appear as Bruce Banner, a.k.a. the Incredible Hulk, opposite Chris Hemsworth, Thor in Marvel's Thor Ragnarok, sources have confirmed. So, it's quote-unquote sources. Marvel hasn't made a press release yet. Mm-hmm. But like I said, given that this is Variety and given that they don't normally publish this sort of thing unless it has some sort of merit to it, then I think it's certainly probable.
Now, you have always told me that you will always wait for Marvel to do a press release.
Of course I will. And like I said, I did say it's all but confirmed. I would never come on this show and release something that was said on, Bleeding Cool or, one of those.
Yeah, Joe Blow
websites. I mean, this is Variety, so obviously they saw it fit to print. Maybe there is something to it. I think it's a great idea because, Thor Ragnarok from the event that Kevin Feige hosted last year at the El Capitan Theater, where he announced Phase 3, he did mention how Thor Ragnarok was going to kind of be the Winter Soldier of Phase 3, in the sense that it's supposed to be the bridge movie that sets up Infinity War. Mm. So if that's true, and from what I understand from people who actually read the comics, if they're following the actual Ragnarok storyline, then it's supposed to be this sort of apocalyptic sort of cosmic event. So it's already sound like it's going to be pretty grand scale. And I think it's a great way to get Hulk back into it, so they don't have to spend part of Infinity War Part 1 explaining where he went at the end of Age of Ultron.
I'm all for this. Like, I think that we could get a cool... Like, it'll still be Thor's movie, just the same way that Winter Soldier was still Captain America's movie, but we had Black Widow. Right. And I think Black Widow only made Winter Soldier better, and their relationship was cool. And I think it would be interesting to see Thor and Bruce Banner together, because Bruce Banner would be a total fish out of water, and we like it would kind of be the audience's ambassador, like going through this Norse god world or going through the galaxy and everything like that. And then we might even be able to set up the Planet Hulk storyline. And I think because it was all about how people sent Hulk away to an alien planet because he was too dangerous. And so he fought and battled on this alien planet rising up. And I think it would be cool for Thor to kind of introduce Hulk into the galaxy, like take him outside of Earth and, into a much larger world of Marvel. And they could kind of piggyback that situation into a setup, their own Mark Ruffalo Hulk movie.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just excited, you know, if it's anything like Winter Soldier, and, you know, it turns out to be a Thor and Hulk buddy cop esque movie, then that would be fun. I'm just excited to see Mark Ruffalo outside of an Avengers film. I think he's earned it by this point.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it'd be a shame to see him only once every 3 or 4 years, especially since he probably has more films on his contract than just the 4 Avengers films that he's going to be in.
Yeah.
So very excited about that. Looking forward to seeing what they do with it. The other small tidbit that I have before we move on is it was confirmed a couple weeks ago, Ant-Man is officially getting a sequel in Phase 3.
And because of this, it's called Ant-Man and the Wasp. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, it's called Ant-Man and the Wasp. And because of this, one Marvel film was pushed up and another Marvel film was pushed back.
Right. So now Black Panther, instead of coming out when it would have on Independence Day weekend in 2018, which is now where Ant-Man and the Wasp is going to be, they pushed it up to President's Day weekend in 2018. Now, I know some people are concerned that February is kind of a dumping ground, but there's a couple things that convinced me otherwise about this. First of all, there's been at least this February, and I think, yeah, last February too, where two relatively solid blockbusters have come out, and because there's little to no competition, they've cleaned up, mm-hmm. and they were pretty good. This year was Kingsman, and last year was the Lego Movie. Now, they were both surprise hits, and because they had little to no competition, they did fine in February. I think given how Winter Soldier performed in April of that year, and Guardians of the Galaxy performed in August, which used to be a dumping ground, mm-hmm. I think Marvel can release a film whenever they want, at whatever point of the year, and people will come to see it.
And also, I mean, we also need to have some faith in Marvel here, because they started off as a small studio, and they're not small anymore, of course, but they're still small compared to Warner Brothers or Fox or, you know, like some of these other companies that have been around for a long, long time. Why would they produce a film that they didn't care about? They wouldn't.
And unlike all those other studios that you mentioned, Marvel just produces this kind of film.
Right.
This is the only thing that they work on.
This is their specialty.
I think by this point, you know, the people, of course there'll be people who are naysayers and still doubt everything, but, you know, part of it's just getting old hat to me, and I know I have a Marvel bias, but, you know, after 7 years of the resume that they had since 2008, haven't they kind of earned the benefit of the doubt by this point?
You'd think, and you know that I'm not a Marvel fanboy.
No, not you, but specifically. But
I understand that. I'm just saying that I agree with you 100%, and this is coming from someone who's not biased, who's not a Marvel fanboy, is that they have a proven track record. Do I have criticisms of Marvel? Abso-friggin-lutely. But they don't churn out projects that they don't care about. They're not at that point yet. Maybe down the line that'll happen. They'll become so massive that they'll diversify and they're like, eh, let's just put this, you know, this random one over in this month because, you know, like because of this person's contract and blah, 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 blah. Maybe that'll happen, but that can happen with anybody. But right now, Marvel has a proven track record of making hits. Are some better than others? Absolutely. But let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let us not try to come up with reasoning behind why they're pushing Black Panther or say like, oh, it's because it's a minority hero. You know, no, that's bull crap. None of that has anything to do with it in my mind.
You know, and I think noise is just being made because it just so happened to displace two movies that are in the minority fan base that the fan groups can get all upset and pissy over. So Black Panther got moved, but it didn't get delayed. It got moved up.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it happens to be in Black History Month, which I think is kind of cool.
I think sooner is better. So I'm all for it. I think it's a good move.
Plus, you know, it's not like we're not going to see him until February. We are seeing him next year. Keep in mind.
Yeah. We're seeing him in Civil War. And so I try to get into the heads of these people, all these naysayers, because there's so many reasons why they need to postpone it, because of other people's schedules or because of distribution rights or because of producer schedules or like actor schedules or, you know, theater schedules or so like a million decisions come into come into when to release a movie. And there's people online who just think that there's just a whole bunch of old white men sitting behind a table in a darker room going, this guy's black, this person's a woman, so let's screw with their schedule just because we don't have faith in them because it's not a white male hero.
And never mind, too, that, you know, notice how, you know, the second Ant-Man movie isn't Ant-Man 2, it's Ant-Man and the Wasp. And yeah. And if this is not a spoiler because the title in itself is the spoiler. But when you see Ant-Man, Tristan, Evangeline Lilly is going to be the Wasp.
It's hard to exist online and not know that. And so I'm not too worried about that kind of spoiler. It's just if like, is there racism and sexism in movies? Holy crap.
Yes.
Yes, there is. It's a pandemic and it needs to be fixed and it needs to be helped. And I am not denying that whatsoever.
Watch a Michael Bay film.
Yeah, watch a Michael Bay film if you want to see some sexism and some latent racism. And it's not just that. It's like it's in our casting decisions. It's in TV. And that should not be ignored. But just because one film gets delayed and another one gets pushed up into a month that you don't like doesn't mean that there's some grand conspiracy. We have enough real examples of sexism and racism in the film industry. Let's focus on those instead of inflating ones that don't exist.
Yes, please. I don't want another Black Widow situation in Age of Ultron, which I think was just way overblown. But the other one that got displaced too. So you know, Captain Marvel got pushed back to March of 2019. And again, you know, we just discussed why people are getting all upset about that. But I think it's kind of interesting that now Captain Marvel is going to be the last solo film before the big Avengers Infinity War Part 2 grand finale, which is supposedly going to – I still think in mind, despite what people are saying about contract renegotiations and re-upping, I think they're going to retire most of the current roster at that point.
I'm with you. I think that's going to happen. Do I have any insider knowledge? No. But do I think it would be a smart decision? Yes.
Yeah. Even just a money-saving decision at that point. At that point, Downey's definitely going away because he's costing way too much now. Like, but, you know, a few weeks ago, Chris Evans said he would play Captain America as long as Marvel wanted him. And as much as I would love to see him stick around, I think they're going to retire Steve Rogers at the end of Infinity War 2. I could be wrong, but maybe not. But my point is that Captain Marvel is now the last solo film before Part 2. I think that's kind of a good position for it to be in, because if people who are really excited about that finale, why would you not see the... It's like, you know, why would you skip the second to last episode of a TV series that you really love? You know what I mean?
And kind of, if you think about it this way, I mean, like, yes, is Robert Downey Jr. a huge moneymaker? Yes. Is Chris Evans a huge moneymaker? Yes. But there's a point in time when somebody's price tag becomes larger than what they are expected to bring in. Mm-hmm. And it, like, look at Star Trek, okay? There was multiple reasons why we did not get a Star Trek 7 with the original cast. Not only was it because Star Trek VI didn't make as much money as they wanted, but they've been thinking about a Star Trek reboot for decades before we got one in 2009. And one of those major factors was because Shatner, Nimoy, you know, all of those people, their paychecks were getting way too bloated.
That's also why Next Generation didn't go beyond season 7. I mean, I know we know that they wanted to do movies, but the real reason was all the cast had a 6-year contract and they all had to renegotiate for that 7th season. And by that time, the paychecks and what they wanted was so big that it's like, you know what? Movies for these people. We can't afford to do season 8.
Yeah, it was more cost effective to do movies. They would make more money by doing movies and paying them a movie wage than doing an 8th season of The Next Generation. It's all about money, people. I'm sorry, that's what it is. I mean,
it is.
Like, movies are not some sort of altruistic form of
creativity.
Of capitalism or creativity. Yeah, it's about the almighty dollar.
Yeah. So whether we like it or not, but I don't know. I think that the fact that Ant-Man is getting a sequel is kind of exciting. I think it's, you know, it should really put to bed any rumors that, you know, Marvel is, you know, impending failure on a movie is happening anytime soon, because last year we had it with Guardians and that made nearly $800 million worldwide. Now Ant-Man didn't make quite as much, but it just opened in China this week. It's sitting at $454 million worldwide. It's on the verge of breaking into half a billion by the end of next week. I mean, I hate saying this and I don't want to jinx it, but if any film was going to fail at this point, wouldn't it have been this one with all its production problems?
Probably, probably. You know what really surprises me is that whenever Marvel comes up on this show, we end up talking about that the longest out of yes. any other selection. Well, I wonder why that is.
Yeah. Well, that's it. We can move on. But all that happened within the last 2 weeks, so you yes. need to talk about it.
All right. So that is our extra long opening news segment, where our primary topic will be shorter than our news segment.
Which is fine.
Which is fine by us, because it'll probably be really short. And our section today is on top 5 scariest moments in non-horror films.
Oh, I did mine in horror films. I just put it in movies.
What the hell, dude? When we talked about this, you said, like, we agreed that it was going to be scariest moments in non-scary movies.
No, I said scary moments that kept you up at night, and I said for you it doesn't have to be scary movies because you don't watch scary movies.
Oh, you freaking suck. I would have had a completely different list. I was racking my brain all week trying to come up with something, and you stabbed me in the back.
I didn't stab you in the back. I swear to God, that's what I said.
I can't believe you did this to me. All right, well, let's move on, all right, with our two entirely different sets of lists.
Okay, so well, why don't you go first? Because you obviously did more work, so like you deserve to show off more.
All right, well, okay, with mine, like most people are gonna laugh at me because this is non-scary moments, and non-scary movies, and I tried to think, okay, so you know, like why would I be scared in a non-scary movie? And I kept coming back to my childhood, mm-hmm. you know, like what freaked me out as a child, and I like this one's not a movie. This is the only one that's not a movie. And it's from a TV show. Huh. It was Beauty and the Beast, the TV show.
Oh, the Linda Hamilton one?
The Linda Hamilton one and Ron Perlman one from 1987 to 1990.
Really? I thought that was like a romantic drama. So what was scary about that?
The Beast himself!
Really?
So I was born in 86. Uh-huh. Okay? And my mom and dad loved this show. And so I was 1, 2, 3, and 4 when this was on the air. So whenever this was on, whenever Ron Perlman's face in his Beast makeup graced the screen, apparently I would scream and run out of the room.
I know what he looks like. Yeah. I guess, yeah, for a kid that would be scary, but Ron Perlman just looks weird. Have you seen it? I mean,
Perlman himself without any makeup?
Yeah, the man's just got an odd, pliable face. And you look at him, and this is no insult to Ron Perlman, but it's no wonder he gets cast as the creature in most movies that he's in.
Yeah, I don't know what it was. I mean, it just freaked me out. But here's the thing. When I was 1, which is when TNG came out, I was terrified of Worf, apparently.
Oh, really?
I was absolutely terrified of Worf. And they could not calm me down when I was a toddler, like 1, 2, and 3. Like, we would watch Star Trek together, and whenever Worf was on the screen, I would, like, cover my eyes with my blanket and then continue to watch the episode. And then one day, my mom had a TV guide, when TV guide was awesome, and they did Star Trek stuff all the time with TV guide. They had an interview with Michael Dorn, and they showed his makeup process. Mm-hmm. And so they had Michael Dorn, no makeup, handsome man. And then they showed the stages of him becoming Worf, and she showed me that as a toddler, and I was like, oh, okay, it's TV magic. And then, boom, I was fine. I could watch the episode no problem.
Once you understood they actually hadn't found a mutant man to be on Star Trek.
That's right, yeah, since they didn't find an actual Klingon. And so I think, like, the Worf thing and the Beast thing, like, was one and the same, where it just freaked me out as a toddler.
But no one showed you the TV guide where they showed Ron Perlman putting his makeup on.
That's right. And so I stayed away from that a little bit longer than I did with Star Trek.
Oh, that's funny. I'm sorry. I just still feel bad that you misunderstood what we were going for here. But
Oh, no, I think you phrased that wrong. You should feel bad because you lied to me. I think not misunderstood. But that's okay. That's okay. That's okay. That's all right. We're still friends. But what's the top one on your list?
Make me feel guilty. Well, you know, I'm also going to go with a childhood fear, and I want to go with something a little bit out of left field, because the other ones that I have are from, you know, mostly scary movies, and I was kind of shocked to discover things that scare me the most are facial expressions, but we'll get to that later as I go through my other lists. But so something that did scare me when I was little, I've always had this random fear of, like, loud noises or loud music when I was, like, really, really little. I don't know why. It's just one of those things that that always kind of bothered me. And what would appear, what would especially terrify me in certain films is if I'm really burying my soul here. I don't know if I want to be made fun of for this, but I can't be the only one who was scared of this. Certain production logos would scare me because of their music or their design. So I'll put number five on my list is the one that stuck with me the most, and one that I think I'm kind of founded on, is the old 1982 United Artists logo from the beginning of their movies. Now, you're giving me this look like I'm talking something really crazy, but it's this weird, creepy logo with this sinister music, and, you know, it ends with this really loud burst of music that comes out of nowhere. And I'm sorry, but if you listen to that on a night when you're alone and with the lights turned off, tell me that's not a little creepy, especially to like a five-year-old, you know?
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I just watched the United Artists Pictures logo from 1982. And it is clear to me that Matt is scared of a production company that was started by Charlie Chaplin, Douglas Fairbanks, and America's sweetheart, Mary Pickford. And I have lost a little respect for you, just a little bit, because this has triumphant music at the end, reminiscent of the Universal logo.
It was scary when I was five, and it was in the dark, too.
Oh my
gosh. I was watching this at night. But you know what? You don't get to make fun of me, because I'll have you know, ladies and gentlemen, Tristan can't even handle the alcohol in a Mike's Hard Lemonade.
See, okay, I knew you were going to bring that up, because here's the thing, is that you yell at me all the time for being a pansy, because I don't like horror films, and I don't like Hannibal, like the TV show, and you can't even handle the United Artists logo.
Did I not mention this when I was five? I can handle it now fine.
All right. We need to move on, because this is some strange territory. I did not think that we would go down. Now, here's something scary.
I wanted to be creative. Shut your mouth.
Okay, here's something that's legitimately scary of all ages, children young and old, and that is from Temple of Doom, where the dude's heart is ripped out by the main bad guy with the horns. So he's like, Kalima Shaktude! Kalima Shaktude! Yo, that's... That was a movie that came out, and it was rated PG, and it was the movie that was the reason why PG-13 was invented.
Well, that and Gremlins, but yes.
Right. And, like, you look back on it, you're like, how on earth was this PG? And that's the reason, because they're like, we need something in the middle. And so whenever I'd watch that movie constantly with my dad, but he would always fast-forward it. He'd always like, close your eyes, son, and then fast-forward it. That's always how we watch movies. And there's, of course, a few times when I would either pop in the movie myself and he wasn't around just because I wanted to see what he was fast-forwarding through. Or, like, he wouldn't fast-forward it and he would just tell me to close my eyes and I would totally look, like, sneak through the Afghan, you know, where I'd, you know, peek my eyes through the holes in the Afghan.
You know, if he really wanted to do you a service, he would have fast-forwarded through most of Kate Capshaw in that movie.
Anyway. That's another topic. And, you know, I watched it and it messed me up. Like, I was just floored. I think... out of all the times that I've seen the movie, which have to be in the multiple dozens, I have seen that scene maybe once or twice. Because to this day, I'll fast forward it.
Really?
Yeah, to this day, because it messes me up. Because the idea that his heart is out, but yet he's still working and living and breathing and laughing and scratching. That messes with me.
But no, I just saw that movie this year, actually, you know, for the first time in a long time. And Kate Capshaw aside, that when we finally get to the Temple of Doom at the end and we get to that scene, the practical effects still hold up.
Oh, hell yeah. It's a great movie. I love that movie. I don't care what people say. I freaking love that movie.
It's my least favorite of the original three, but it's still a good film. I'm surprised. Well, maybe it will come up, but I'm surprised like the face melting didn't get on top of that from Raiders.
No, the first time I saw that, I was much older, so it didn't really mess with my head.
Oh, so did you see Temple of Doom first?
No, I just, like, my dad would just fast forward it.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't peek during that time.
Okay, gotcha.
So it
gotcha.
Didn't mess with me, because once I was older, I was like, claymation.
Okay, well, I will give you points. That's actually frightening.
Thank you. What's your number two?
My number four. Counting down from four to one. But my number four, actually, it's weird because like I said right before I did my number five, in an odd way, the rest of my my list has to do with facial expressions. And I think when someone just gives a creepy look or expression into camera that really sells the mood of a scene, it really stuck with me more than anything else. So my 4 through 1 all have to do with someone's facial expression. So my number 4, it's one of my favorite endings to any kind of, if you want to classify it as a horror film, I guess it would be. I really think of it as more of a thriller, but it is a horror. It certainly was a horror for its time. And I'm thinking specifically of the end of Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, where it's you're seeing Norman in his cell, and you're hearing him have the conversation in his head as Mother. And it comes to the end of that scene where the fly's on his thumb, and he looks in the camera with that, you know, she wouldn't even hurt a fly. And you just see him smile, that smile, and it fade. It would really cool is it crossfades into the skull of the Mother, so it's like superimposed on the other. I saw that film when I was 11, and I saw the edited for TV version. Even then, that face stuck with me for more than anything. I think that's when it was right around that time when I was starting to discover how much I liked horror, and I kind of liked the sensation of being scared. Because before then, I really didn't. But then I figured out there was something adrenalizing about it, and that kind of unlocked something within me. And so that still is one of my favorite ending shots. Well, it's not really the ending shot, but it's one of the last shots of the movie. Anthony Perkins' smile at the end of Psycho has stuck with me for a very, very long time.
Yeah, that's very, very iconic, very, very solid choice. It's something like he just kind of like represents the crazy evil, and that smile lets you know that he's not done.
Well, not only that, like, you know, in spite of what the sequels say, like that smile at the end of the thing just tells you like he will never be Norman again. He is always Mother.
Yeah. Yeah. Good choice. Solid choice. All right. Well, with my next one, this one is I have like there, all of these are when I was a child, now that I realize it. And this next one is probably the most ridiculous out of all of them.
Okay, so we each get one ridiculous one. So, okay, fine.
Yeah, but none of these are a logo. So, you know, like, I know that the Starbucks logo kind of, you know, like, gives me the heebie-jeebies here and there. But United Artists is still okay. But with this one, it's actually from a cartoon. It's The Little Mermaid.
Really?
Yes. And I cannot tell you why. I don't know if it's because of my own relationship with my father or what, but when King Triton destroys Ariel's treasure trove of human goodies and oddities and things like that, I get terrified. And I would run up the stairs whenever the scene would happen and then run back down when it was done. I'd be like, is it over? They're like, it's over. You can come back down. And it messed me up. I hated seeing him angry and just destroying things and throwing things around. And it just...
I feel like I should get all Freudian on you now. So did you have a particularly domineering father when you grew up, Tristan?
Well, see, that's the thing, is that like it makes you ask those questions, because my dad was and is very much a man's man. Like he growing up, he's a very strong individual. He's shorter, but really stocky and strong, you know, huge muscles. And I was terrified of my father, but in a healthy way. Like, I had a great relationship with my father, and I always felt like I could go to him for everything, but he had a temper on him when we were kids, a huge temper. He is much mellow now. He's a big, soft teddy bear, and he'll cry during Pride and Prejudice. But it's, like, when we were growing up, you know, like, he had quite the temper on him, so I think maybe if you wanted to go Freudian on it, I just didn't, like, seeing Triton made me think, like, oh, you know, my dad's gonna get angry and scream and yell if I have, you know, mermaid, you know, oddities in my room when I should be staying on the surface or something like that. I don't know. But yeah.
So Trident destroying the treasure trove is your number three.
That's my number three. Also a tie with Batman the Animated Series Two-Face.
Oh, that was creepy looking when I was you're right. You're kind of right. And actually the when I was younger, I used to think that the intro sequence was kind of haunting too. Not scary, but creepy. I like the opening title sequence of Batman the Animated Series.
Good description. All right, what's your next one?
So this was bound to make an entry at some point, but again, it's not only the film that made me a real horror fan, but it turned me on to noticing how things are technically directed and lit on a in a film, and how much that can add to the character of a scene. And of course, I'm talking about Halloween. I just saw it, you know, in preparation for the season. It's being played on AMC ad nauseum. But there's a point in that film that I think the atmosphere and the direction and the cinematography all mesh together to create one really, really creepy image that has always, I think it's my favorite shot in any horror film. And I think I actually, a couple of months ago, Tristan, you remember when we were doing those four perfect shot memes on Twitter? Like, yeah, you know, you had to identify four perfect moments or screenshots in movies that you love. This was the moment I ended up choosing from Halloween, and it's still my favorite. I think it's my favorite scene in a horror film to this day, where it's just after Jamie Lee Curtis has discovered all the bodies of her friends. She finally realizes what movie she's in, because she's oblivious for most of that movie. But she finally realizes what movie she's in. She ends up backed against a wall next to a threshold to a completely darkened room. And then the director of cinematography on that film, Dean Cundey, who I think is brilliant, he's lit a lot of different films over the years, to reveal the mask, which is creepy in itself because it's just a blank face, again with the facial expressions. Out of the darkness, you just see this light slowly, slowly come up, and you just see the white ghost face of the mask standing right behind her, right before he comes out to try to attack her for the first time. And that scene, it certainly scared me when I was 14, but it's always stuck with me as, like, that is just perfect direction, it's perfect music, it's perfect cinematography, it's all these things working together to create the atmosphere of a scene. And that's the first time that I noticed how important the technical direction in a scary movie can be. So that's why it's my number three.
Absolutely. Yeah, like the light and shadow and feeling, yeah, it's absolutely critical to a film like Halloween and a horror film overall. Solid choice. So my next one, this one I blocked from my memory for a long time because I remember having nightmares about this one. This one, these last two, I had literal nightmares because of these moments.
You know, I thought of a couple of these kind of moments too, Tristan, and I left them off this list specifically because I could see you using them as ammunition for me later. Like, just texting me pictures of certain scenes from movies that, to this day, I still can't watch and refuse to watch and will still give me nightmares. And so I just didn't want to put myself in that position where I could be easily traumatized. But please do continue.
Now, like, the thing is, though, I'm going to pry that information out of you somehow so that I can use it against you in that exact same way that you described, because whenever you try to rub it in my face that the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo sequel is never going to happen, I'm just going to send you screenshots of your nightmares.
See, and that's why you will never figure them out.
Well, okay, with this one is, it was my mom's birthday over the weekend, and I was trying to come up with a list, and I was actually talking with my family, and I said, I was like, hey, do you guys remember anything that freaked me out as a kid? Like, and they came up with Beauty and the Beast and Worf and all that business. And I said, I was like, was there anything else that you remember me screaming out in the middle of the night, you know, soaking wet from sweat and maybe something else, and just going like, you know, Mom, Dad, I had a bad dream. And they're like, well, you know, we're not really thinking about it. And then for some reason, I started getting flashes of Jem Henson. I was like, why am I thinking about Jem Henson?
I know, someone who brought so much joy to people's lives.
I know, so much joy to children all across the globe. And I'm just like, why do I keep thinking about Jim Henson and nightmares? And then I started, like, regressing back into the, speaking about Freudian, you know, like, I started regressing back into my dreams. And then I started remembering people pulling out their eyes. Like, people pulling out their eyeballs and just seeing it dangle from the retinas and just, like, right in your face, right in the camera. And I'm like, what is that? And so just 30 minutes ago, I went on Google and typed in Jim Henson eyes pop out. And the first thing that came up was from The Labyrinth, and they're the Fieries from The Labyrinth. And it's these little orange and red fluffy monsters that just kind of dance around and sing around Jennifer Connelly. And it's horribly matted together. It's horrible. It's just atrocious special effects. I mean, the worst special effects you've ever seen in your life. And these animals just, like, are jumping around and are clearly puppets. And they take out their own eyes and put it on their fingers and go towards the camera, like a kind of like a 3D motion. Then they pop it in the air and then catch it in their mouths like popcorn and then swallow their own eyes. And then it's back in their eye sockets. And that messed me up.
Yeah, well, you know who you might have to blame for that.
Are you talking about like Beverly Crusher, Gates McFadden? Like, I have to blame Gates McFadden?
You might have to blame Gates McFadden because she may have choreographed that. I don't know.
Yeah, I might have to bring it up to her. I actually, you know what? I'm gonna. She's on Twitter. Hopefully, she'll see it and maybe she'll answer. But yeah, I'm gonna have to bring this up to her and say, like, are you the cause of the traumatization of my childhood? Seriously, like, I remember waking up in the middle of the night just screaming.
And so you saw this, and like the floodgates opened and it all came flooding back.
It really did. Like, once I saw it, I was just like, oh, holy crap, this is what bothered me. Yeah.
So do you have a thing with eyes then?
Yeah. Well, I mean, who doesn't, you know?
Yeah, I know, but so there's certain people I know people that really like have a problem with eyes, like anything that has to do with eyes.
I can't take eye drops.
Like, oh, really?
My wife has to hold me down.
So you like you mean like I when I was, you know, like a child, and you have to do that. Your mom has to keep your eye pried open, and
yep, she has to do that. I'm a grown ass man, and she has to do that to me. So maybe that's why. Maybe I can trace it all back to Gates McFadden and Jim Henson and David Bowie and Jennifer Connelly.
You never know. The source of all your childhood nightmares might actually be Beverly Crusher.
It might be. All right, what's your next one?
All right, we're getting up to my number two. And like I said, I'm never going to share stuff like that with you, because to me, I would use it as a cathartic experience, and for you, it would just be ammo. Okay, so continuing the theme of creepy facial expressions and creepy smiles, and again, talking about 70s horror now, this is not a slasher film. I mean, people do die in it, but I would not call it a slasher film by any means, and I don't know if you've ever seen it or not. You might have, since you're a God-fearing man, but I'm talking about the original 1976 The Omen. Have you ever seen it?
Yes, I have.
Okay, so yes, you are, because you're a God-fearing man. So you have seen it.
And a Gregory Peck fan.
My dad can't watch that movie to this day. He has a thing with the devil. Like, he doesn't like seeing the devil personified on screen. And he's not that big of a religious person. He just, it's something that was inbred to him as growing up Catholic, I guess. But he can't watch The Exorcist either. But again, so you have a multitude of creepy moments, you know, the nanny hanging herself, mm-hmm. David Warner, who possibly has the greatest death in horror movie history, that would be, you know, Chancellor Gorkon from Star Trek VI.
Right.
Gets his head decapitated in what's some of the best practical special effects in a horror movie that I think I've ever seen. That did freak me out when I was a kid, but the thing that freaked me out more and the thing that stuck with me, again, is the last shot where, you know, if you haven't seen the movie, I'm spoiling, you know, what's almost a 40-year-old movie at this point. But, you know, they find out that their adopted child is the Antichrist, and so Gregory Peck has to try to take him out. The only way he can take them out is with these special daggers. So he ends up taking him to their church because it's got to be done in a church, and trying to stab him. It's going to try to stab him. But the police get there just in time and they shoot Gregory Peck. So the kid ends up winning in the end. The devil wins in The Omen. But the shot that stuck with me the most, and again, saw this when I was 11, saw this the same year I saw Psycho, it's that look into the camera that kid gives at the end, and he just smiles knowing that he won. And that is a creepy-looking little kid. Yeah. I don't know where they dug up that kid, but he was perfect, as you believed he was the devil's child. And I'm not even that religious, and I'm, you know, it made me scared of the devil. So Damien's smile at the end of The Omen, just, you know, as he's looking into camera, realizing that he's won. It's so creepy and so effective. And with Jerry Goldsmith's satanic choir, it just, ooh, that scene was perfect.
Yeah.
That was a perfect ending.
It's a very good ending to a very classic film. All right, so we're coming up on number one. This is our top moment, and this movie, I don't have one single moment. I could probably bring it down to a few, but, and I'm going to swear here, and I'm going to bleep it later, because I want everybody to know how serious I am about this, and we try to keep it family friendly, so you'll have to forgive me. David Cronenberg's The Fly.
Oof.
With Jeff Goldblum and Geena Davis.
Yes.
That movie, okay? I know. That movie, oh, I saw it on TV, okay? TV, television, okay? Network television on like a Sunday afternoon.
It's a great film.
And my, I think I watched it with my dad. I still haven't forgiven my father for this, but I watched it with my dad, and we both thought, hey, you know, Tristan's a young person, but it's edited for TV. How bad could it be? I don't know. That's the, I just know I was young enough for it to mess with me. Like, I think I was prepubescent. That's all I can remember. It is surprising. When you look at the 90s, like, what they got away with showing on TV, they would never get away with today on basic, like, on network TV, like ABC, CBS, and everything like that. Like, the movies that they would show.
Yeah, not in today's family-friendly, coddling TV culture.
Yeah, whether you like it or not, whether you think it's a pro or con, it's just a fact that the rules were much looser back then. Like, TV was not as edited as it is today. And that movie, holy crap, just like the amount of just like, what's the term for it? Like, body morphing torture?
It's body horror.
It's body horror, that's what it's called?
Yeah, we call it body horror, yeah.
Okay, I figured you would know what that was called. Yeah, it's just like the changes that he goes through, you know, like where like he sheds his skin, or like he start, like when he vomits on a dude's hand because he's a fly, and so they have like acidic,
yeah,
you know, vomits to digest their food, and his hand melts, and then like he's arm wrestling a dude and he just cracks open his wrist.
It's so creepy. And even stuff that doesn't happen to him, when Gina Davis has that dream sequence where she gives birth to a larva.
Yeah.
That's weird too.
Oh, I cannot believe, like, those images were introduced into my brain and they never left. And if I could erase one movie from my memory, that would be it. I would never watch it ever again in a million years, and I wish I could erase it from my mind, because my mother told me at a very young age, and I take this to heart. She said, Tristan, anything that you put into your brain, you can never take back out. That struck a chord with me, and I try to live my life that way with certain things that I present myself with whether it's music, movies, TV, stuff online, whatever it is, I try to remind myself, and I hear my mom's voice, anything that you see is stuck in there forever. And right. I wish I could scrub the fly clean.
There are things that certainly I would qualify that too, but like I said, you will never know them because you won't let me you wouldn't let me forget them. I'm supposed to be your friend and everything, and you would just never let me forget them.
It's true. I never would. Now, and also to qualify this list, like these are all like moments when I was a kid, or like things that freaked me out. There are a lot of things that disgusted me that I've seen in movies, or things that have unsettled me that I wish I never saw. But they're not scary moments. It's just like,
yeah, there's a real distinct difference between scaring and disgusting.
Yeah, like The Fly is kind of like bridges that, like, it's scary and disgusting. But, like, you know, like rape scenes in movies, or sexual assault, or violence against children or women, you know, like there are things like that that I wish I never saw or unsaw, like, or, you know, like never knew about in movies. But I mean, those aren't scary moments. Those are disturbing moments.
Yeah. Again, you sound a lot like my dad. My dad will never watch any film where there's a child in peril, because he can't take it.
Yeah, yeah, I understand that.
So, I guess I should go on to my number one, and this was my number one, again, another horror movie, again, something that I saw, I think, I want to say I was 10, because I think I saw this when I was in fifth grade, or, like, about to go to sixth grade, but it was right around that time of my life, and I knew I wanted to see scary movies. It was one of those things, like, growing up in the Blockbuster age, where there were things on shelves and art on shelves, like, I would always find myself in the horror section of the store, because as scary and creepy as some of those artworks things were, they had, you know, artwork, VHS artwork in the 90s was kind of brilliant, was it not? I mean, like, I would sometimes pick things off the shelf just based on the cover art of the film. And for whatever reason, I found myself in the horror section a lot, and my parents would never let me watch anything. I wasn't allowed to watch anything until I got to that age where they were finally like, okay, you can watch certain ones of these movies. And so I would literally have my mom with me in the aisle. I would ask what I could get, and she would tell me what I could get. So this was one of the first things I saw when I was that age. It was Brian De Palma's Carrie, a movie that I've talked about a lot on this show. I don't know. I can't remember why that was on the acceptable list, but for whatever, you know, my mother's a social worker and she, you know, I trusted she knew what she was doing. So I wanted to see it. The cover art was great because it's, you know, Sissy Spacek standing there in blood amidst in flames. Mm-hmm. So it's like, why not watch that movie? So, you know, I watch that movie. I'm sufficiently having a good time being scared throughout and until I get to the prom scene. And for whatever reason, you know, again with the facial expressions, when Sissy Spacek in that film finally cracks and she has those really wide eyes and she just kills everybody in the prom, her looking like that stuck with me that whole night. I couldn't sleep. And I thought it was, you know, and while I couldn't sleep, I don't know what this says about me, but that's the movie that convinced me I wanted telekinesis as a power. I was a bullied kid at school, so I was like, you know what? I wouldn't kill anybody necessarily, but I think I would really like telekinesis to shame people.
Yeah, just a little torment here and there.
But, if you Google any screenshot of Sissy Spacek and Carrie amidst the blood and when she's attacking the prom, that facial expression always just stuck with me. So that would be my number one. That's the first thing that, like, from an actual horror movie that terrified me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Because I actually think I saw that before I saw Psycho and The Omen. I think Carrie was, like, one of the first things I ever saw.
All right. Well, that's our list. That's our top five scary moments from mine from non-scary, typically scary movies, except Fly was a little bit of a cheat there, and yours are from scary movies and a logo. So we thank you so much for listening. As we said at the top of the show, please go to thenerdparty.com, check it out. Go check out our blog, which is very limited right now. Please go to our Facebook page and like us and leave us a comment at facebook.com/thenerdparty. And please, oh please, if you haven't yet, leave us a review and a rating on iTunes. It really helps us out. Remember to subscribe as well.
Yes, and be sure to follow us individually on Twitter. I am at mhansen0207, H-A-N-S-E-N. Tristan, you are on Twitter as well.
I am at theinsanerobin.
So thank you so much for joining us for this very scarily good time on the Nerd Party. We hope you have a happy Halloween season where everyone's entitled to one good scare.
Coming up next week.
I found it a very appealing script. It's really wonderfully written. It's very funny. It's scary when it means to be scary. It is extraordinarily well informed about the genre itself. So it's just chock full of references, you know, both obvious and subtle. I mean, mothers and fathers' names are characters from Halloween 6 and everything else. I mean, there's just it's like you need a concordance. You could go back and see this film 5 times and miss some of the references.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
There's been a red card, but for who, Chris Kamara?
I don't know, Jeff, has there? I must have missed that. Red card? No, you're right, I saw him go off, but I thought they were bringing a sub on, Jeff.
Make sure you don't miss a thing with a Now TV Sky Sports Day Pass as the season reaches fever pitch. Big moments? No contract. Get in. Get your pass from nowtv.com. 18+, UK only. Content streamed to compatible devices. Full terms at nowtv.com.